Chapter 8. Jack Aubrey turned away, having said the oh-so-familiar last words over his old shipmate, Henry Woodbine. And he'd not walked the length of the deck before the lookout hailed a signal from Ringle, far away in the clear Norner West. "Jump up with the glass, Mr. Hanson," he said, and stood there waiting while the young man raced up to the fore-topgallant cross-trees. "Sir," his clear young voice came floating down, "Ringle says, believe Cape Pilar north, a half west, perhaps 35 miles. With a greater deliberation, but with an even more beating heart, Jack rose to an even greater height, settled himself comfortably on his familiar perch, and directed his telescope to the horizon well beyond the distant schooner. The cold clarity of the air made for excellent visibility, yet there was the inescapable curvature of the Earth's surface, and a moment's calculation assured him that what could just be made out from the distant Ringle's masthead wouldn't be seen from Surprise for the best part of an hour, even if she maintained her present beautiful 10 knots. Nevertheless, he lingered, the cold biting through his dreadnought grego and his wonderfully unbecoming woollen bonnet, and in time he half persuaded himself that he could make out a nick in the horizon within 5 degrees of the required position, a horizon otherwise as taut as a hard-stretched line. Slowly, easily down, and as he walked aft through the questioning gaze of the watch on deck, a sadly diminished watch by now, to the cabin where he found Dr. Maturin stirring a tankard of mulled claret over a spirit stove. "Take a sip of this, brother," said Stephen. "It'll help dispel the cold. I've added a pinch of ginger to the nutmeg and the cloves." "It goes down very well," said Jack, "and if anything could replace coffee, right mocha, freshly roasted and freshly ground, it would be this. Many thanks. Have you heard the news?" "Not I. Paul, Maggie and a horse-leech from the starboard watch have been administering enemas to the many, many cases of gross surfeit that have now replaced the frostbites, torsions and debility of the recent past. The very recent past. Strong, fresh seal meat has not its equal for upsetting the seaman's metabolism. He's much better kept on biscuit, Essex cheese and a very little well-seethed salt pork, kept on short commons. What is the news, Tell? William signals land 30-odd miles to the northward at maybe Cape Pilar, which is laid down in just that position. I'm so sorry. I thought we'd done with capes. Take a little more wine for your stomach's sake. Bad if you insist. But let me tell you, Stephen, that although Cape Pilar, or Cape Desayado, as some say, forms part of Desolation Island, yet another Desolation Island for all love, it's a wonderfully comfortable sight to a seaman bound for the Chilean coast, because just beyond that blessed cape lies the Pacific Ocean. Do you mean we may survive? Oh, I shouldn't go as far as that. But presently I shall desire Ringle to reduce sail and ask William to dine with us after we've both made a very, very careful noon observation. Then we shall compare positions and rejoice or lament as the case may be. Killick! Killick there!
Sure.
Pass the word for the master.
Pass the word for the master it is, sir,
replied Killick with, for him, an extraordinary degree of good humour. And Killick, tell my cook to lay on as decent a dinner as the bark he can provide. Ringle will be coming aboard. When Killick had gone, Jack said, Stephen, I don't suppose the sick bay's comforts could be laid under contribution for the feast.
Well, I might be able to spare a little, a very little, portable soup,
said Stephen. And I will myself look through my stores for 2 or 3 decent bottles of wine. And so this, you tell me, is virtually the Pacific? Unless dear William's totally lost his wits with longing, the waters of the two oceans mingle off the seaward point of that Cape Pilar, and the Pacific, you will recall, bathes the coast of Chile and Peru, stretching up to the Isthmus of Panama and on to Nootka Sound and the frigid Canadian shore. Come in, Mr. Daniel. Let me tell you that one of your first duties as master's mate of this ship is to make a most meticulously exact noon observation. For as I dare say you've heard, Ringle, far ahead, has signalled a probable sighting of Cape Pilar with something very near the right bearing. And please tell Mr. Harding, with my compliments, that I should like him to make all reasonable sail to close the schooner. Within moments there was the sound of intense activity on deck, the bosun's oddly cracked bellow urging people to tally and belay, the thump of racing feet and the creak of blocks, and all the countless notes that made up the ship's voice rose in pitch and intensity, while the run of the sea from her cutwater aft grew more urgent by far. The sea, if it teaches nothing else, does at least compel a submission to the inevitable, which resembles patience. And all those concerned contained themselves with a decent appearance of that virtue through the clear hours of approach. To be sure, for both cabin and gunroom, there was the delightful discovery, at least for those who understood navigation, that their positions coincided in the most gratifying manner. And then, of course, there was the feast, during which it was found that a really full-bodied Burgundy went admirably with seal steaks. But the real, truly relished delight came well after this, when, well topped up with American rum, they stood in the foretop, Jack Aubrey calling up the midshipmen one by one and bidding them take the most particular note of that tall, naked mountain at the tip of the island just ahead, the mountain with two pillars of rock on the seaward side, the higher quite black. They were never to forget that landfall because it marked the western end of Magellan's Strait. And then, with tolerable luck and a west or nor'west breeze, a ship could be carried through to the Atlantic in a week. They had perfectly delightful weather after Cape Pilar, with clear skies, to gallant western breezes with none of that cruel bite of ice, a truly blessed sea with great smooth rollers riding gently in towards a shore so distant that it was only the faintest loom, a sea with here and there a whale, and fine fresh fish taken over the side in God's plenty. And above all, this sea was Pacific. No sudden dreadful squalls. Never a night when all hands were called, plucked from their half-warmed hammocks, to confront hail and ice-caked decks, tops and ratlins. Health began to return, and with it laughter, capers, mirth. And at last the African cats came from their refuge in the galley, where they had what very little warmth was available south of the Horn. This enchanting weather lasted from one Wednesday until the next. And on the intervening Sunday they rigged church, all hands in pretty good clothes, though few chests had escaped a soaking, trimmed by the barber and his mate, pigtails combed and replaited, and the singers, who made up most of the ship's crew, in good, hearty voice. Jack read them one of Taylor's sermons on intemperance, to which they listened gravely, while the Ringles, just under their lee, had to put up with the articles of war yet again, Mr. Reed having little confidence in his powers that way. From well before dawn the following Wednesday, it was clear to everyone aboard that they were going to have it rough. But few who hadn't seen the appalling drop of the barometer could have imagined quite how rough they would have it, or how soon. The wind came dead foul, of course, blowing from the nor'west with ever-increasing force and against the flow both of tide and of current. At two bells, all hands were called to bring the ship to and to veer out a drogue. It was tarpaulins again and ice in the wind, and a freakish cross-current whipped the crest of a tall wave clean across her side, flooding the galley and putting out the fires. The cold, the hard, hard, very hard toil of keeping her just so, and a bare poles followed and no more than a scrap right aft, pumps going without a pause, was about as severe as anything they'd gone through, bar the even more deadly threat of the massive, far southern ice. When at last it did blow itself out, they were almost too tired for relief, though Jack did observe with grave approval that the schooner had come through quite well. Her headrails were gone, for the most part. Her bowsprit was little more than a stump, and she'd had to ship a new bright yellow boom, but she looked more buoyant than the surprise.
They were lying there in a still violently agitated, dirty sea, and clearly they were nearer the land than he'd reckoned. In this cloudy evening light, he couldn't see it. But all along to starboard, there were shattered trees, masses of vegetation, as though kelp beds had been ploughed up or steep-to land carried away. Far out to westward, he thought he could make out a distant light. "Mr. Hewell," he said to the officer of the watch, having pondered a while, "let's signal to Ringo, make what offing is feasible." He saw the coloured lanterns hoisted and acknowledged, told Harding that the watch below might now indeed go below, once grog and a reasonable piece of smoked penguin and biscuit had been served out. He noticed the first lieutenant's glance at the word biscuit, but without taking it up, he went below. The sick berth was more or less what was to be expected, indeed dreaded, after so sudden and so severe a blow. Less, rather than more, seeing that there were now fewer to have limbs strained, dislocated, even broken. And now all were seamen, thoroughly used to the most furious extremes of weather, and to having one hand for themselves as well as one for the ship. He did what was proper and customary by each, and he observed that Stephen had been as generous as usual with his laudanum where there was severe pain. He'd known surgeons who, out of something like a vicarious asceticism, would allow nothing but liniment for even the worst of torn muscles. "And for yourself," he asked privately, "how have you come through this blow?"
"Tolerably well, my dear, I thank you," said Stephen, "but I could do with a biscuit and a swallow of brandy." "The brandy we can do at a pinch. But as for the biscuit, when you have a minute, come on deck. There are some prodigious curious trees a little way inshore. But the light's almost gone. I have three fractures to splint and then I shall be with you." The light had indeed faded, but Stephen could still receive the strong impression of an utterly disordered ocean, uneasy with acres of yellowish scum, irregular and sometimes conflicting waves, and wreckage from the coast all over what coherent surfaces it had. Just under the rail where he stood, one of those immense Chilean pines, with harshly recurved, sharp-pointing leaves, was being fended off for fear its trailing roots. Its roots! The whole hillside on which it grew, having obviously been carried away, should foul the rudder. "It is indeed an astonishing sight," said Stephen. "But if you'll forgive me, I believe I shall turn in. I die on my feet. Do you not find the air growing curiously thick?" "In another 10 minutes, I believe, we shall not see our own bowsprit. In these waters you often get fog after foul, and by God, it was foul." Stephen Matter had always thought himself justified in making quite sure of a long night's sleep when he was very tired by swallowing enough laudanum or anything else that came to hand to deaden a horse. It was, therefore, extremely difficult to wake him early in the morning. "Don't go to the devil, you hideous ape," he said, in a tone of exasperated hatred. Then he heaved over in his cot, pulling the pillow over his head. But it wouldn't do. Slowly, by dint of steady, unvarying repetition, the message came through. A hull whaler was alongside, her master aboard, pleading for help with a wounded man. A man whose arm, caught in the line, running furiously out as a harpooned sperm whale dived, had been horribly mangled 3 days ago. "I'm no more fit to operate on a mangled arm than I am to bind up a cut finger," he said, sitting up and looking at his hands. "What's that smell?" "It's coffee. The whaler brought us a couple of pounds. Should you like a pot?" "Well, I might," said Stephen, looking quite human, even intelligent. And when two or three remarkably strong cups had dispelled some of the poppy, hellebore and Jamaica rum, his deeply rooted sense of duty, of medical duty, began to return. He said, "What is the name of my loblolly boy?" In a conciliating voice, Jack said, Paul Skeeping. Is the sea calm?
Mill ponds ain't in it. You astonish me. Did you not hear the dead flat thunderous rain all night?
I did not.
What am I to do? Asked Jack, afraid that he should drop off again. Why, beggar, to go across and take a general view of the patient. She's an intelligent woman. They exist, whatever you may say. She had the good word of my old friend Dr. Tevan. She's had a world of experience, and she'll tell my poor battered, stupefied mind what to expect. She told him, as she put on his clean shirt and tidied his hair, that St. Luke and all his fellow apostles couldn't save the arm now, nor the whole College of Surgeons of Dublin. But she thought that his honour, if she might say so, could possibly save the poor creature's life by taking it off at the shoulder, still quite a clean joint. And she'd told the whalers what to do, what to prepare, and she'd put up the usual implements. The time to cross two decks and to descend into the well-lit cabin where the patient lay fighting his pain, his grief and his dread was enough to restore the medical Stephen to life. And after a cursory examination that wholly confirmed what Paul had said, he carried out a rapid, unusually satisfactory amputation with excellent flaps of healthy skin, which he'd scarcely dared hope for, and he murmured into the patient's ear, There, it's over. You'll do remarkably well if you lie quite still and drink no spirits at all for a week. Is it over, sir? Asked the patient. I didn't know. God bless you.
On deck, he said to the master of the ship, You will stay here beside the ship, if you please. I'm reasonably sanguine about your man, your brother, I believe. And I should like to dress his shoulder tomorrow and show the most intelligent of your shipmates how to carry on until he's quite well.
I've always liked whalers, said Jack,
still waving, though they were half a mile apart on a blessed calm forenoon with a fine breeze for reaching.
They have to be right seamen to survive at all. People call them rough and their ships all a-hoo, and to be sure they kick up jacks a-dying on shore. But then they live rough, most uncommon rough. Yet for open-handed, I don't know their equal. Though in general, sailors are not often called skinflints. Carling, there, Joseph Carling, would have emptied his hold if I'd let him, but I wouldn't accept more than a couple of casks of biscuit once I'd heard that there was a small sheltered port, or rather anchorage, within reach. A little place called Killion, where most of the whalers down here go for their stores. The place is kept by a hull man married to an Indian woman, and he knows just what they need. A pause, and Jack went on, gazing after the whaler, now hull down. It's pleasant to see how sailors recognise one another all over the world. I'm sorry you were too busy aboard Ringle and with your patients here to dine with Carling and me. You would have heard about some fellow members of the Royal. Do you remember Dobson?
Austin Dobson?
The entomologist?
Just so.
Of course I do. The proceedings wouldn't be what they are without him. There are no less than three beetles named after Austin Dobson. In fact, there may by now even be a fourth. Have you heard about his inheritance? Come, my dear, pray don't let's tease one another with question and answer. I find that I'm somewhat fractious today. I've been made to work far too hard. I'm nourished on most indifferently preserved penguins and seals, and I desire you to give me a plain, straightforward, seaman-like account of our colleague. Very well. Let's go below and sit in comfort. There. Put up your feet and calm your spirit. Austin Dobson, now, had a remote cousin whom he didn't know, had barely met, who lived in gloomy splendour somewhere far in the north where coal is mined and shipped from Newcastle. Now, this cousin died, and Dobson inherited some ludicrous sum. Millions, I don't know how many, but millions. And he instantly set about doing what he'd always longed to do. He bought the Lisbon packet
a very stout serviceable craft designed to make rapid passages across the Bay of Biscay, and with an adequate crew and 5 or 6 friends, all fellows of the Royal Society, botanists or entomologists, and 1 authority on marine life, all men of wide interest, he set off by way of the Cape to India, Ceylon, the Spice Islands, and so across the Pacific. They looked into Juan Fernandez, and now they're working up the Chilean and Peruvian coasts as far as the Panama Isthmus, where 2 mean to cross and take ship the other side, carrying the seeds and more delicate specimens. They have university commitments, while Dobson and his remaining friends carry on to Nootka Sound, returning by way of Kamchatka, where 2 of them mean to study the economical rat of those parts. "What a noble ambition!" cried Stephen, clasping his hands. "What fortitude, too! For however comfortable the packet, and those I've known have all been neat, padded, and, as it were, well sprung, these men have already traversed some waters that call for a certain resolution, continually renewed between Cancer and Capricorn. And even in a very well-found packet, there is sure to be a certain monotony of diet. No, no. It's a noble way of enjoying an inheritance. I honour him." Jack said, "I'm sorry you weren't there. You'd certainly have known most of them. You go to the Royal much more often than I do, and to the dinners. My friends there, the people whose papers I read with most attention, are the astronomers and mathematicians. These men here, of course, were primarily naturalists of one kind or another. And when the 2 craft put into San Patricio together for stores, they asked the whalers all sorts of things about whales, the various kinds, depth of blubber, pregnancy in whales, where found, numbers in schools, accompanying young, ambergris, where located. They both laughed. Stephen had once been cast ashore on a coral island where his only companion, apart from a few crabs, was a piece of ambergris. Why do we laugh? There was nothing droll about your situation or our anxiety," said Jack. "Perhaps because you found me, so it all ended happily. But, to be sure, laughter is sometimes wonderfully obscure. Whenever my mind moves with that piece of ambergris, I feel the birth of a smile. I do hope we meet these men. Theirs is a very respectable curiosity, and I, for one, long to know the answer to some of their questions." Jack was called away at this point, something whirling about among the sails in all probability, and Stephen sank into a by no means agreeable fit of musing. He might not possess the millions attributed to Dobson, and indeed very large sums were required for that kind of exercise, but he was what most people would call rich, or at least quite rich, and yet he'd done no more than consider a journey into the Atacama Desert to examine the effects of extreme aridity, and another to study the life of the Caucasian snowcock. And these mere considerations had led to nothing concrete. He had contributed nothing to the sum of knowledge. Some part of his mind at once offered a flood of denials, excuses, attenuating circumstances, assertions of his distinguished merit, his unbroken record of observing Lent as strictly as any man, not even in minor orders. But he remained low-spirited, and he was glad to see Jack reappear with the news that the damn four comes and carried away, but all was fast at a tanto now. The words that followed 4 sounded very like a piece of obscenity, far, far grosser than anything that Jack was ever likely to say, and Stephen was still trying to recapture the sound and interpret it when he became aware that he was now being told about Daniels and Hansen's zeal in plotting their course for the whaler's refuge of Pilon, behind its protecting island. They had Joseph Carling's bearings, his outline of the island from southwest and due west, his directions for the entrance to the little bay, and an at least approximate table of the tides. "With this sweet breeze we should be off the coast a little before high tide at 9, said Jack. "We shall lie under the island's lee and send Ringle in with the 2 purses. She can lie alongside much easier than Surprise, and there's an awkward turn in the channel where we might just touch and she wouldn't. All the whalers know it and take care if they're deep laden. I could wish the sky looked a little more promising. But a quick turn round and we're in 100 fathom water heading north with a full hold." All the whalers knew the awkward turn in the Pilon passage, But they didn't know that the frightful, shore-tearing storm had combined with a minor local earthquake, usual in those unhappy regions, to block it with a massive landslide. And the Ringles, advancing cheerfully towards the bend, just waiting to put the helm hard over, ran straight onto the sharp-edged new-fallen rocks. It was a pale and shaken Reed who pulled round in the gig to report this to Captain Aubrey. "Never mind, will you, miss, sir? Just lead us in, sounding all the way, and we shall see if all anchors out astern and the capstan can heave her off. The tide's still making." They did heave her off. With a shuddering groan at the very height of flood, all hands and all the men of the little village sweating at the bars, and she lurched backwards into deep water. But their triumph was silenced by the rise of broken woodwork from below, from her stem itself, and from the larboard cutwater, some of it copper-plated. They beached her moderately well on a smooth sea lion's nursery, and at low water they found that the wounds, though horrible, were not deadly. Both carpenters and the few skilled men in the settlement, who felt it extremely and who admitted that there had been a slight earthquake, worked with the utmost concentration, and at the next high tide she floated. Clearly a well-equipped yard was necessary, the complex assembly of her bows, though nowhere wholly pierced, had been cruelly wrenched. She couldn't bear anything even near half pressure on her foremast, and although she could make some modest way if she met no really savage head seas, she would need a dry dock and highly skilled hands to bring her back to fighting trim. "My dear," wrote Stephen yet again, but now sitting in reasonable comfort at his desk, "I have no doubt that you remember that exceptionally amiable young man with one hand replaced by a steel hook. His name is William Reed, and I've been attached to him these many years. But he, alas, was in command of the poor schooner when she ran full tilt into what amounted to a bar of rock and very nearly destroyed herself. Now that sheltered piece of water was perfectly calm. The awful crash of rock loosened and cast down by an earthquake had long since died away. And an estimable whaler who knew the little small harbour intimately had laid down the bearings of the passage or channel with meticulous accuracy. The poor young man is in no way to blame. Nobody, least of all Jack Aubrey, who brought him up from childhood and who loves him and esteems him, does blame him. Yet he walks about bent, weighed down with imaginary guilt. I've prescribed, for she carries no surgeon, poor thing, a modest cathartic, and tonight he'll sleep, will sleep indeed, with a seasonable amount of help from me and the blessed Poppy, together with a few minims of hellebore, God love him. But otherwise I must say that although the southern parts of this prodigious continent are forbidding, and bear such well-deserved names as Port Famine, Cape Froward, and Desolation Island, if one does but survive and persevere, one comes to regions, to whole stretches of coast, where the southerly current is both constant and wholly favourable, and where the breezes often favour a gentle northward movement, which is all that we can reasonably desire or pray for, until we reach San Patricio with our poor crippled Ringle and, I trust, a cure for poor dear William's melancholy, which moves his people so that I've seen them shake their heads and clasp their hands as he goes by. At present this most curious sea, this piece of the enormous ocean, is filled with utterly innumerable small fishes, so very like anchovies that I doubt if I could distinguish between the species or genera, unless I had the true Mediterranean creature in my hand for comparison. A little trawl, negligently drooped over the side, provides us with a dish of whitebait. Rather large whitebait, it's true, but eminently palatable in a trice. But our pleasure is as nothing compared with that of the seabirds of this region above all, or at least most obviously the vast, bulky pelicans. They circle about us with rapturous cries, plunge, gorge, rise into the air mute while they're cramming down their prey, dive, rise again, and so it continues. There are rocks and headlands all along this coast where these birds, too heavy at last for flight or merely sated, spend the later part of the day and the night until dawn when they begin again. Their voices as fresh and piercing as ever, and these rocks are white with their droppings. Indeed, these deposits, this guano, is said to have a depth of 10 feet and even more. At present we coast very gently along. I think we have no more than double reef topsails abroad, and the distant, somewhat veiled shore, with here and there a remote white gleam from the still more distant Andes, scarcely seems to move. Yet our devoted navigators take careful observations every watch, and every watch the pins on the chart advance perceptibly north towards San Patricio, where we are confident of at least 3 capital yards. Indeed, so near are we now that Captain Aubrey is having the barge carefully overhauled and beautified to run in with me, so that the chosen yard shall be ready to start as soon as Ringle comes. He takes me not, as you may well suppose, for my advice in sailing the boat, but merely for my ability to speak Spanish. Horatio has just come to tell me that the headland marking the southern end of the estuary on whose shores San Patricio has its present being is now in sight, and that the captain will soon have the barge afloat. I must fetch some respectable clothes. But first, I must tell you that San Patricio, like many another settlement on this uneasy shore, has already had other sites destroyed by earthquake or fire or its opposite, a vast engulfing wave that seems connected with the earthquake, and that not only destroys the ruins even more thoroughly, but that will carry a ship, an 800-ton ship, up and through the town, sometimes setting it down, as by a giant's hand, upright on the debris. Though it's possible that I may confuse San Patricio with other towns. So many on this unstable shore have suffered from all these calamities, as well as from pest, plague, and piratical rapine, too. Leaving the frigate at anchor on good holding ground well off their coast, Surprise's barge pulled smoothly up the confluence of 2 rivers towards San Patricio. And as she was coming into the fairly well-inhabited part of the town, the docks and wharves to starboard with a good many craft and a few ships alongside, plain astonishment burst through the ordinarily mute coxswain's reserve, and he cried, "By God, sir! There's the old Lisbon packet painted blue. Painted blue, by God. Oh, I beg pardon, sir." "So she is," said Jack, following his gaze and the gaze of all the bargemen. "So she is. But what a difference the colour makes. I'm not sure I should have recognised her. God love you, sir, I was a boy aboard her. And being she was a packet, they liked her to be kept navy fashion, and there ain't a brass handle, knob or bolt, I don't know. Watch your stroke there, bowel." Jack turned to Stephen, who was watching a flight of pelicans, and said, "Four craft along to starboard there are your friends, I do believe. Our colleagues of the Royal." "Oh," cried Stephen, "but they've painted her blue. Could the boat row over, do you think, so that we may hail her?" Jack gave the necessary orders, and they moved gently across the stream. "Take care to paint your moonstruck bastards," called an angry voice in Chilean Spanish. "Watch out for the paint. Don't touch it for your life. By God, it's Maturin. And Aubrey, how very pleasant to see you here, dear colleagues. Pray thread your way through to the wharf, to our other side, which is quite dry, and come aboard. We have some really excellent lemonade." How they talked, how they quaffed the excellent lemonade. The bargemen were dismissed to an eating house on the open quay a little way along, and the fellows told of the horrors and delights and discoveries of their respective voyages, several of them talking at once now and then, and all as hoarse as toads by the time Jack stood up, begged leave to go and look at the various yards for his wounded tender, and engage them all to dine aboard Surprise tomorrow. "And if I may, gentlemen, I will pluck Maturin from your bosoms. He speaks the Spanish, you know, which I do not." "One hears very high opinions of Lopez," said Dobson, "and he was certainly most obliging with our paint and a small leak." It's the second yard on the right as you go up the stream, said an eminent botanist. The first is occupied by the Chilean Navy. They got along, but slowly, partly because there were several small yards on either side, whereas they'd heard of only three, and partly because parties of waterfowl passed overhead, sometimes in great number, and Stephen would come to a stand, cursing the absence of his telescope, and trying to make out the bird's nature despite the absence. They were approaching yet another quay, and Stephen threatened to come to yet another halt, as a very lofty flight of long-legged, long-necked, crane-like birds came across the sky, when they heard a voice from the other side of the road. Aubrey! How glad I am to see you here. Are you looking for Asp? Lindsay! What a pleasant meeting. It must be years and years since I last saw you. Yes, indeed, said Lindsay, walking over. He was wearing a uniform very like that of the Royal Navy, but with rather more lace. I dare say you're looking for Asp. At the moment, I'm looking for Lopez Yard. It's just beyond the theatre, but perhaps you don't know the town. Lord, no, this is the first time I've ever been here. And apart from drinking lemonade with some fellows of the Royal Society, we've done nothing but walk along this quay. Fellows of the Royal Society? Those men in the former Lisbon packet? I dare say you were very much at sea in that learned company. Their slight acquaintance did not at all warrant this familiar tone. And Jack left a distinct pause before he said, May I introduce my political adviser, who is also a fellow? Dr. Maturin, Sir David Lindsay. Your servant, sir, said Lindsay, somewhat confused. And to Jack, should you like to look at Asp? She's just across the way in the naval basin. They crossed, and with increasing confidence, Lindsay pointed out the various changes he'd made, particularly the lengthening of the deck for more guns aside. Jack had reservations, but he didn't utter them, contenting himself with the observation that the Asp must have made a remarkable passage. By God, yes, but I was in a hurry, and as you know, I've never been afraid of cracking on, so I took the straight. Some people say it's dangerous and prefer to creep round by the Horn, but I don't mind a little danger. Then I took the straight. At one point, just after the second narrows, when we were very nearly close-hauled, the wind began to back before we were handsomely round the cape, and with tears in his eyes the master begged me to put into the sheltered bay. But no, said I, in for a penny, in for a pound, and we rounded the point with barely a fathom to spare. Well done, said Jack, feeling that it was required of him. And for a while Lindsay stood relishing his feet and murmuring, in for a penny, in for a pound. But then one of the circling crane-like birds dropped a turd on his hat. He wiped it fairly clean with a piece of sea-rack and then went on in a more matter-of-fact tone. I was in a hurry, of course, as you'll understand, and I got here in very good time. I've already looked at almost all my bases, almost the whole of my command, Concepcion, some of the smaller island places, Talcahuana, and now this. But I must tell you, Aubrey, he went on after a significant pause, I must tell you that the discipline, sense of order, and indeed elementary cleanliness, to say nothing of seamanship, are not what we could wish. That is one of the many reasons why I'm so happy to have a man like you, of your reputation, under my orders. What you say is particularly kind and flattering, said Jack after a considering pause and a glance at the wholly impassive Maturin. But I'm afraid there's been a misunderstanding. As a post-captain on the active list on detached service, I am under the orders of the Admiralty and of nobody else on Earth. Lindsay reddened, and after two false starts, he said, I am Commander-in-Chief of the Junta's naval forces, and as such... How do you mean, Junta? The combination of authorities that make up the Republic. The Republic of the whole country. The entirety, apart from a few dissident northern bases near the Peruvian frontier that will soon be liberated. And as such, he went on resuming his official voice,
It is within my power to press your men and impound your vessel. Gentlemen, said Dr. Maturin, in a voice that expressed neither authority nor impatience, but that did stress the need to speak in a lower, more adult tone, and to abandon rhetoric, it is surely time to sit in the shade. And although tea can scarcely be hoped for, yet coffee may well be had, or mate, there is an agreeable awning at no great distance. The gentleman, as I believe I said before, is my political adviser, observed Jack. Lindsay bowed again and said that coffee, iced coffee, was indeed to be had under the awning. It was with evident relief that they descended from this near crisis and sat in the shade, called for their coffee, and talked for a while like ordinary human beings, discussing common acquaintances, the few ships still in commission, and the fate of officers, particularly junior officers, flung on shore and living there on half pay. Then Stephen, having found that Lindsay was somewhat less foolish than he'd appeared at an earlier stage, laid out the position, or a chosen part of the position, as it was seen in London. Government was in favour of Chilean independence. It didn't much care for some of the members of the Southern Junta or group of juntas, and hadn't committed itself to anything resembling recognition. It was on better terms with those in the North, and there had been a certain indirect intercourse, a certain understanding. But if any vexation, let alone violence, were offered to a ship even remotely connected with the Royal Navy, the effects on Chilean independence would be disastrous, disastrous. Whereas a more or less tacit cooperation in suppressing Spanish privateering or the like, to say nothing of Peruvian invasion, would have entirely the opposite effect. Sir David was no doubt perfectly aware of Surprise's force, her fighting reputation, her superbly well-trained crew. Her prime and ostensible function was hydrographical, above all surveying. But in the course of her activities, she might well have many and many a chance of helping the infant republic to full and acknowledged independence. If Sir David would make all these facts clear to the many influential men with whom he was in contact, he would do both countries a very great service indeed. They parted with expressions of goodwill and assurances on Lindsay's part of the most wholly discreet cooperation in case of need. And when they were separated by a decent stretch of ground, Jack said, "How can that young man have been so bubbled, so wildly deluded as to think that I had come out to join him? I'm deeply puzzled. For, as you observed, he's not altogether a fool. Yet he really believed what he was saying. And to believe that, even in peacetime, a post-captain quite high on the list and not reduced to actual beggary should consent to act in such a wholly unauthorised caper and to serve under him, it passes imagination. Certainly, I can advance not a shadow of official approval or qualified assent, no instant solution, no convincing hypothesis at all, but a line runs, or rather limps, for I don't think I have it right. Jockey of Norfolk, be not so bold, for Dickon thy master is bought and sold. A few yards farther, and he said, "I've had a certain experience of hunters, and I must say that quite often those combinations for a common aim bring out the worst in men, they generally having private ends in far greater mass than the common aim. And, Jack, it is my belief that you too have been bought and sold. Some considerable member of the Northern Junta that first approached you, having defected to the South and having transferred your services, as he might those of a common mercenary, to his new friends. But I speak very much at random and must submit my notions to Jacob's vastly superior local knowledge and connections. I hope to see him in Santiago. But meanwhile, we've done no harm.